He couldn't buy his way out of this one. Alex Murdoch, fresh out of rehab with a pair of felony fraud counts staring him down, now faces several more nights in a South Carolina jail cell and quite possibly many more years locked up. And then, has law enforcement given up on finding Brian Laundrie in the swamp? That nature reserve was reopened to the public today. Did they waste a month and millions searching in there? And which of the dozens of Brian Laundrie sightings should they take seriously, and which are a waste of time? That's tonight on Banfield. He's on a bike. He's on a deer cam. He's hiking in the Appalachian Trail, maybe even bedding down in a campground in Puerto Rico. How are the FBI to know which tips pouring in about Brian Laundrie sightings are worth chasing down or worth tossing out? Another one came in today, and there's video to go with it and a bike. We're going to play it for you shortly and show you the very curious trip that was taken by his parents today and why the cops might want to take note of the places the Laundrie parents went. First, though, you cannot put a price on freedom. But judges kind of do it every day, right? Just over a month ago, Alex Murdoch had a $20,000 price tag put on his freedom. In legal terms, that's what we call a bond. And he was back in rehab before the ink was even dry on that order. But that was then, and tonight is now. And Murdoch is no longer free, no longer in rehab, and no longer going anywhere, at least for a few more days. Because today, a very different judge with a very different attitude in South Carolina refused to grant bond in any amount for the one-time titan among Lowcountry lawyers. A man now charged not only with trying to stage his own murder, but also with cheating his late housekeeper's family out of millions in death insurance. Oh, and there's more. Before that judge will even consider any bond for Alex, the judge wants the defense to pony up a psychiatric assessment to support their claim that Alex Murdoch is not a threat to himself or someone else in the community. For Murdoch, that basically means a week or more in a jail cell, quote, to get comfortable being uncomfortable. And that quote comes from my first guest. His name is Eric Bland, and he's the lawyer for the family of that housekeeper. The lawsuit he filed against Murdoch just weeks ago paved the way for this latest batch of charges. And we're also pleased to welcome Seema Iyer, chief legal correspondent for Fox 46 Charlotte, and a very smart lawyer herself who was there in the courtroom for the whole proceeding, plus a good friend. So welcome to both of you, and thank you. I'm going to start with you, Eric. You sat through the proceeding. You spoke in the proceeding, and I dare say you were a little shocked by the judge's decision in the proceeding. Explain.
Not shocked. This is a no-nonsense judge who believes in justice. It's the type of justice that Alex Murdoch usually doesn't see. This judge is a former prosecutor and doesn't like people of privilege that abuse their position and do the things that Alex Murdoch did. So I wasn't shocked about how severe the bond was going to be. I was shocked that he decided to override what the prosecutor from the state's attorney general was proposing, which was a $200,000 bond. And he took time to reflect after we finished our arguments. He asked me what I individually thought, and I said, I think he's a great danger, clear and present danger to my clients and society. He's already stolen with a gun. Used a gun in a crime, and now he's stolen with a pen. And I think that it's high time that he be denied bond. And sure enough, the judge did deny him bond.
Yeah, I mean, I have to say, not even hearing the prosecutors ask him to deny bond, you know, asking for a $200,000 bond. Seema, you've been in many a courtroom, both as a litigator and as a journalist. So I thought for sure you probably would have done a second take on that one.
Absolutely, Ashley. I was actually offended that the prosecutor asked for such a low amount of $200,000 bond. Why didn't they ask for millions? And Eric was there, and he was compelling, and he remembers before the judge took a recess, the judge even said, maybe I'll set $10 million, maybe I'll set $15 million, who knows? So we were already on notice that the judge may do this. And God bless the judge for having the guts to go there.
Yeah, and I'll tell you what, Eric, jump in on this. All I've ever heard since the beginning of the Murdoch name being sort of common parlance now across the country is how these guys rule the roost. They've never had to really struggle through any kind of legal challenge, that they, quote unquote, make things go away because they are so powerful and that they operate amidst sort of this surrounding of whispers. Those who would dare to whisper their name out loud or talk about them, you know, fear for their safety and security, and then came today. So talk to me about the feeling of your client who was, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think he was off to the right of you. One of the children of Gloria Satterfield was in the courtroom with you, along with Gloria's sister. This must have been quite a day for them.
It was, and I think what really moved the judge was this, at its basic level, is a lawyer stealing money from clients. And we're all lawyers in this courtroom. And I said that this was a tremendous stain on our profession and a black eye on our state. And I think it really moved the judge, because this is a judge that was looking at a lawyer and looking at his clients that were sitting behind him, especially a lawyer who stole from the children of the housekeeper who raised his own children. And I think at the end of the day, it was a judge trying to send a signal to not only lawyers in our state, not only citizens, but around the world, that South Carolina justice is going to be pure. It's not going to be tainted. It's not going to be fixed. And when you come before this judge, if you stole money from a client, you're going to be treated just like anybody else. And I think it resonated and it moved the judge to make the decision he did.
Yeah, I want to put up that picture again of you in court with, I think it was Brian Harriet, one of Gloria Satterfield's sons, and Ginger Hadwin, Gloria's little sister in the pink there, and they're in the checkered shirt beside Eric in the dark suit. That's Brian Harriet. You know, I can only imagine that Eric, Brian felt like, how did I all of a sudden get some stature here? Like, I feel like I'm getting some justice. And I'm assuming Ginger may have felt the same way.
Yeah, he did in a way. But this is also new to him, the justice system. He was very uncomfortable being in a court. He had never been around this many lawyers, certainly not cameras from a small town. It was a very scary process for him. And it was also scary to see Alex Murdoch entering the courtroom in chains and in prison attire. This is a man that he revered, the family revered. They viewed him as family and as an important man. And here he is having the courage to go to the lawyers to be retained to bring claims against this man. And I told you last month that I believed that this case was going to be the epicenter of ultimately beginning the takedown of Alex Murdoch and all that, all the bad things that he did. And I think we are on our way to seeing that. And I believe there's going to be more charges coming.
I was going to say, I can only imagine the mixed emotions that Brian would have had, feeling the power all of a sudden in the courtroom there, finally, after years of no power. But then also realizing, but I used to like that guy. You know, he was like family. By the way, you just mentioned it. I want to read from one of the affidavits in this case today. It sort of felt, Eric Glenn, like it was ripped from a page of your suit from a few weeks ago. It said, Mr. Murdoch created and owned a bank account titled Forge and directed Fleming, that's Corey Fleming, the lawyer for your clients, to write the check to it to deprive the Satterfield family of insurance settlements. So I want to go now, if I can, I'm going to ask the control room to play this moment from outside the news conference, outside the courthouse, because that's where Dick Harpootlian, Alex Murdoch's lawyer, decided to address the press. and talk about sort of shifting the blame to Corey away from Alex Murdoch over to the, you know, Corey, that's the lawyer. There's the guy you want to look at. Take a look at this quick moment of news conference sound.
In the Satterfield case, he wasn't a lawyer. Now, he may have signed some documents, but the lawyers are responsible. Her lawyers are responsible for making sure that was done correctly.
So, Seema Iyer, you're a lawyer again. You get it. There's things you say in a courtroom, and then there's things you say to people like us outside. And I think you were part of that gaggle out there. So walk me through all the stories that were told out of the courtroom.
Okay, here's something that's really important to understand. When you're a lawyer, you're always a lawyer. So right now, Ashley, you know, I work full-time as a journalist, but I still have a license to practice law, and therefore I still have a fiduciary responsibility, and I'm still an officer of the court. So I found the defense team's arguments that he wasn't acting as a lawyer in that capacity to just fall flat. These lawyers had nothing to say, they had nothing to argue, so they had to say something. And actually, Mr. Bland even intimated that as well. And Mr. Bland is the one who brought in the South Carolina bar as another victim, which I thought was really important. Not that the judge didn't know this, but now it's on the record. So the world knows it.
Yeah. And I think what's interesting, Eric, you know, Seema brings up a really good point. You lawyers all talk, you know, you lawyers, you know, it's a small community. And leading up to this, I think a lot of you were really teed off. Yeah, you do. I know you do. But I think, you know, as a professional community, it's a blight, right? When something like this happens. So, Eric, I want to play something you said in this court hearing. I actually didn't expect that you were going to talk, but you spoke alongside the prosecutors, and I thought it was really interesting about, you know, you saying, like, it sounded like you were a little mad about what Alec has done and that he deserves the place he's sleeping tonight. Have a look at this.
Today is the day that Alex Murdoch needs to get comfortable getting uncomfortable. And I ask you to look at the crime. This is a crime of a lawyer stealing money. My partner and I have been doing legal malpractice for 30 years, and we have never seen such a breach of trust.
So, Eric, it's good to get that out there, you know, and on the record. And then it's also good to get a check, because I know that your clients still aren't whole, right? There was, I think at last count, what, $4.3 million that they were owed. I don't know if you have the number top of mind, but can you tell me where we're at with your clients getting the money rightfully theirs from insurance companies, from Fleming, and from Alec Murdoch?
Nothing from Alec Murdoch yet, but we filed some list pendants on some of his properties. I would say we're getting to the point where we're going to be halfway. We're getting close to halfway to the halfway point, but we're going to, I think, collect more than $4.3 million because there's additional damages of income tax consequences, of the attorney's fees that my clients are going to have to pay that they wouldn't have paid before. So I believe at the end, and it's going to come pretty soon, we're going to get to the point where we're going to be able to announce that our clients have been made whole, that they've received their cup of justice. And it's time that Alex receives not only his cup, but a bowl of justice. And I think he's going to get it. And he's going to eat that bowl for a couple weeks now in jail. And he's going to get a feel of what it's like when you commit a crime in the state of South Carolina. It's just going to be the start,
Eric,
for him, and there's going to be more charges.
There you are, working in list pendants and bowl of justice, all in the same answer. Thank you for that. Seema, thank you for the long day. I think you were up at 4 a.m. to cover this, and then here you are at 10:13 Eastern.
I'll do anything for you, Ashley. Ashley, are a friend for life, and Banfield's a pleasure. Thank you.
Be still my heart. Okay, please thank your photographer, too, because I know he did a really long day as well. Seema Iyer joining us from the scene.
Thank you.
Great job. Eric Bland, you don't get off the hook so easily. You're not going anywhere, sir. Stay seated, as the judge would say. This case is complicated, and I don't have to tell you that when a gunshot wound to the head is up for debate. Who knew? I've never seen anything like that. But now come the documents purporting to show what the pictures of Alex Murdoch's head clearly do not show. So what was it, Alex Murdoch? Did you have horrifying injuries to the back of your head? Because this picture doesn't seem to show that. We're going to break into that in a moment. Welcome back. Between Alex Murdoch's latest arrest and this morning's bond hearing, his lawyers tried to clear up another pesky intrigue. And in any other case like this, honestly, this is an issue that would not need any clarification. But they released Murdoch's hospital records from Labor Day weekend. Remember that? When, according to Murdoch and according to South Carolina police, he was shot in the head on a lonely country road by Curtis Edward Smith, a.k.a. Cousin Eddie. When Murdoch appeared in a local courtroom just 12 days later, it was not lost on most of the people watching that he did not look like a man with a still fresh gunshot wound to the head, back of the head. And the documents speak of two superficial appearing bullet wounds to the posterior scalp, causing a skull fracture, a brain bleed, and temporary vision loss. So again, there's the back of the head 12 days later. But it is very confusing. Eric Bland is still with me to sort this out. And we're also joined by another friend of the program and veteran of the Murdoch saga, Andrew Davis. He's an investigative reporter for WSAV in Savannah. Andrew, I'm not sure how those medical records match up with Alex's lawyer's description either. The picture is one thing, but then, you know, Jim Griffin said entry wound, exit wound. It's just all very confounding. Is anybody able to really sort this out?
No, not so far. The documents are supposed to clear a lot up, but really all they did was confuse everything more. Plus, if you look in those documents, Alex's statement was where he was at the beginning, saying, well, I was just sitting there trying to change the tire when somebody came up. So Cousin Eddie, in this point, Curtis Smith, has nothing to do with this. You're talking about a man also who was shot in the head, has a skull fracture and hemorrhage in the head, yet they're only talking about very mild pain. And I don't know much. I'm not a doctor, nor do I want to be one or play one on TV. But I can tell you that if all that happened, I would think the pain would be much more significant than what they're talking about. And you're looking at a situation where I think they pushed the medical records out as much as anything to prove that he did have barbiturates and opioids in his system, which was clearly marked and even highlighted for everybody to see when they sent that to us.
I mean, honestly, you know, I looked at that and I thought, if I was going to do this plan, I would take every bottle I had and swallow it beforehand. So that wasn't such a surprise to me. But Eric Bland, I want to just read for you some of the terms that are included in these medical reports. They're very fancy. Subdural hematoma, fracture of the parietal bone, subarachnoid hemorrhage. But when I asked Joseph Scott Morgan, who's a certified death investigator, and he knows what those all mean, he actually said the fracture was likely from the expanding gas of the gunfire, a concussive thing, not necessarily a bullet. And he was quite specific. He said this is a superficial gunshot graze wound, likely that it was, you know, close range. That made perfect sense, but unlikely that it was self-inflicted, which is also sort of intriguing all at the same time. But what I really wonder is what does all this mean when it comes to the truthfulness when they come to litigate in court, if that's what they ever do, or at least settle in court and give, you know, affidavit statements? Like, I'm trying to get my head around this head issue.
It's a race to the bottom between Alex and Cousin Eddie. Who are you going to believe? Who are you not going to believe? I mean, Alex's credibility at this point, somebody that you can't trust. He was going to commit insurance fraud. He filed a false police report. He stole $3.3 million from my client that he's charged with, another $118,000 worth that's going to come, I think, within a week. I think what is not on that medical record that I would look for is, why is there not any gun splatter residue? There's no GSR on there. And if he was shot at close range, there would have been some gun residue on there. There would have been some powder. There's none of that there. Yes, he could have been grazed by a bullet. Yes, it could have happened by percussion. A lot of that is subjective medical diagnosis based on what Alex is maybe telling the physician or a reporting nurse when he was taken to triage. So The records for me create more questions than answers. For me, I didn't see any of the gun splatter residue. So I have grave doubt on whether it happened the way he said it happened.
when you bring up those terms, I get these like visions of Phil Spector and OJ and the gunshot residue that they tested on Phil Spector's hands. And then the splatter, you know, that's another whole science, sometimes questioned or not. But, you know, in this case, they look like they had a victim as opposed to a perp. So maybe they didn't bag those hands and test them like they normally would. I want to play, if I can, this moment on Good Morning America on Friday, where Dick Harpootlian started to really dig in and set his narrative for his client. And it was all pointing at the you know, poor cousin Eddie over there, who I think is going to have an uphill battle. But take a look at this. And just as you listen, think about the who you're going to believe now. Take a peek.
He met with Smith, called Smith. Smith was his longtime drug dealer, according to Alec. He met with Smith on the side of the road, gave him the gun, said, I'm going to look like I broke down, drive by and shoot me, which is exactly what Smith did. They don't put people in intensive care units these days or any time unless they need intensive care. He suffered a bullet wound to the head.
Andrew Davis, I kind of thought he was going to just fall on the sword and hope for the best, but it really might look like he's actually not going to fall all the way onto the sword. Am I off?
No, I think exactly. You're right on. I think he's finger pointing at anybody he can to try to deflect from what Alec has said and done. I thought Mr. Bland said that really well earlier today, saying as the defense lawyers are going, well, he's clean now, so everything should be fine. But he spent 20 years with this supposed opioid addiction and was willing to take cases, deal with the solicitor's office as well. So you're talking about criminal cases and civil cases on top of that. Curtis Smith's lawyer sits back and says, Curtis has never changed his story. He hasn't changed once. Meanwhile, Alec's story and Mr. Harpootlian's story seem to have altered over time to try to point even farther towards the opioids, now farther towards Curtis Smith. And I think he's going to point directly at Corey Fleming now to try to take some of that away as well from Mr. Murdoch. I think he understands and has said Mr. Murdoch is going to jail, but how long is going to be the question. If he can put as many people in the gun sights of this instead, if you might want to take that term, then I think he's looking to try to limit that time as much as possible and see how many other people are going to end up in that cell with Alec.
Eric David, or Eric, Andrew Davis, Eric Bland, both of you, thank you for all your wisdom and your time and spending all that time in the courtroom and then bringing the news to us. We appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Thank you for having us on.
Still to come, the manhunt for Brian Laundrie could be entering an important new phase because guess what? The swamp is back open for business, folks. So what does that say about all the sightings of Brian Laundrie? Which ones are real? And which ones are garbage? That's next. Welcome back to Banfield. Another possible Laundrie sighting, this one in Florida, this one featured on TMZ. It's from Dunalan, Florida, about 3 hours north of the Laundrie's home in Northport. You have to look closely. It's shot on surveillance camera. Appears to show a man with a beard and a large backpack riding a bicycle on a rural dirt road. He's very unsteady on the bike. At the edge of the frame, it appears, just watch closely, that he gets off the bike and then kind of heads into the tree line. And unfortunately, that's where the surveillance cuts out. The property owner says that he has submitted this footage to the FBI and that that's a good thing because it seems like it's possible the feds might have some time on their hands to look through this video real closely because this morning the Carlton Nature Reserve, where law enforcement has been so busy looking for Brian Laundrie since last month, we're not so busy there today. It's reopened. You can go. You can walk right in just like our Brian Enten was able to do. This is the same spot we're showing you where Brian Laundrie's dad, Chris Laundrie, was seen with the police October 7th, I guess showing them, you know, Brian's favorite places. But it seems whatever he told them didn't amount to much. Or maybe something he did or something he said told them that this is not where they are going to find Brian. And speaking of the Laundries, they, on the other hand, were very visible. Out and about running errands today, hitting a Walmart. Look at the logo in this video. Look at it right above the hood of the car. It's an AT&T store. And if you follow this story, I know that you see that as important. It wasn't the only place they went either. They went to a bank. They went to a FedEx spot. News Nation's Brian Enten is staked out at their home. Normally, you know, Brian, we wouldn't really care much about that, except for that they have a son on the run and going to a bank and going to an AT&T store, which was the focus of so much energy about the burner phone that they had apparently picked up before Brian went missing, and then going to a FedEx place. All of these things made me wonder, did anyone see police tailing them? Was there any surveillance on what they were doing, why they went into the bank to get money instead of a machine? Who was the package they were, you know, sending off to? Was there a tail that was visible?
No, not that we could see. I mean, there may have been something that we didn't see, but this was a long journey they took this morning. Roberta and Chris getting into the red truck bright and early. This was their longest venture out that we've seen, I think, since I started covering this 5 weeks ago. Maybe the one trip to Orlando when they met with the lawyer was longer. This was about 4 to 5 hours. You mentioned it, Walmart, FedEx store, 30 minutes inside the bank. They went to one AT&T store, which was closed here in Northport. Then they went to Sarasota, which is about 40 minutes away, where they went into another AT&T store. They were inside there for another 20, 30 minutes before returning back here to the house.
Two AT&T stores?
Yeah, so the first one was closed that they tried to go to here in Northport. So then they went on to Sarasota and were able to go inside there.
So, again, I you know, this might not be a big deal to a lot of people, except for that last night we had Seth Ferrante on the air with us, who said that he stayed on the run with the help of his parents and that his mom would send him brownies, would actually package up brownies and ship them to a post office box, and then also would have monthly phone calls with Seth while he was a fugitive for 2 years. So it made me wonder, as they go about these what look like mundane tasks, it would seem that the feds would be well served keeping an eye on exactly what the tasks are.
We didn't see any feds following them today. It doesn't mean that they weren't there. But I'll tell you this, Ashley, there were a lot of media trailing them everywhere they went. There was one photographer taking pictures as Mr. Laundrie left the Walmart and went to his car. So they definitely knew that they were being watched and that there were media at every single stop they made. They were driving quite fast at one point. So I'd imagine that they know that the media is keeping an eye on them and where they went.
I mean, most people who follow this story think they hold the secrets to the end of this story, to some final closure for the Petitos, and you know, for the hemorrhaging of money to stop in the effort to find Brian Laundrie. All right, let me ask you this about the reserve. Shazam, we can just all walk in there now. You could go in there, you could shoot, you know, with Luis. It's over, done? It's just millions out the window, finished? Or do we know anything more about the reserve?
Well, I have to tell you, it was so weird today, having been here and feeling like we could never go in the reserve. We were always out on the road. There were police blocking the entrances. The gates have been closed. It was like this forbidden place where there could be this dangerous person on the run. Remember, just Friday, there were the police out there in the tactical gear with the assault rifles in the reserve. Well, today, suddenly, the reserve is back open. They tweet online, reserve is back open to the public. We went out there. We were able to go right in. There were people hiking. There were people mountain biking. There were people walking their dogs right in the area where Chris Laundrie was, like you mentioned, where he was showing the officers where he says that Brian Laundrie used to hike. And it was just so strange that it seems like now, poof, the reserve is no longer the focus.
It's so nice. I mean, look at that guy with his dog. I'd like to go on a walk there. I wonder how many people were looky-loos. You know, some might want to walk the dog. Others might want to see what all the fuss was about.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I talked to a couple people in there who were there just for that reason, feeling like, oh, I want to come see what it's like. Plus, the weather has cooled down here. And there, you know, it's a swamp in a lot of areas where you don't want to be. But there were some parts. I was actually surprised going in with the cooler weather. There were some very nice spots.
So one other quick question about the sighting today. This happens a lot. It happens a lot more than we know, Brian. They don't tell us about all the sightings, but this one made it onto TMZ. We just showed it was the guy on the bike that Donnell in Florida, not that far away. And it was a really remote, untrafficked road. Do we know anything about how seriously this one's being taken?
Well, it's about 3 hours north of here. You saw one thing that really caught my eye was that the guy was really unsteady on the bike. Like, I don't know what that was about. I mean, it's like these other videos we see. I mean, is it possible it's Brian Laundry? Yes. We know that the FBI now has the video. There's another woman I talked to again just tonight who thinks she saw Brian Laundry close to Northport tonight, appearing to be homeless. You know, there are a lot of people that have really good intentions that think they're seeing Brian Laundry, but at the end of the day, you know, most of these videos that we're getting, they don't pan out.
Yeah, so I'm going to get you back here if I can. You and Luis, if you could take a couple minutes down, I want to get you back to answer all the questions that are coming in for you, Brian. And there are some really good ones tonight. So Brian will be back a little later in the show. You can tweet them to @TVAshley or @BrianEnton, and we'll get them up there and get Brian to answer them for you. So we were just talking about this. Where does the manhunt go now? So many sightings. Brian Enton's been talking about them. Brian Laundry. He looks like kind of everybody. He's so generic. So how does the FBI sift through the good tips and then the bad stinkers? I'm going to ask a former assistant director of the FBI exactly how they work. If you're like me, just about every time you see a bald guy who's young and a beard, you think it might be Brian Laundry. And doesn't have to be in that reserve either. That's why a lot of people call in thinking they've seen him. The former assistant director of the FBI Criminal Investigations Unit, Chris Swecker, knows a thing or two about tips like this guy on the bike and the guy on the deer cam and the guy on the Appalachian Trail. Chris Swecker, how on earth do you ply your trade when the whole world is watching and everybody's calling it in?
You have to have a lot of resources working on the case. People have no idea how much is going on behind the scenes as these leads come in. And you have to bucket the leads, credible, less credible, you know, in that spectrum of credibility, and go after the ones that you prioritize first. But, you know, you have to have a national agency like the FBI or the U.S. Marshals or a federal agency to handle this, because the sightings are all over the place. They're on the Appalachian Trail. I've heard sightings in the Bahamas and Mexico. This is extremely resource intensive, and you have to think long and hard before you put it out there to the public to call in on these leads.
It's kind of like a blessing and a curse when you have a high-profile case and a high-profile fugitive. And I'm just going to list a couple for our audience so that they'll sort of do the nostalgia moment, because I know you lived this, Chris Swecker. So Eric Rudolph, that was your thing. You dealt with him for years looking for him. I'm sure thousands of tips regularly came in that you'd have to get through. Elizabeth Smart was missing for 9 months, and that beautiful young woman, I'm sure dozens upon dozens would continue to come in until they finally did find her. Lacey Peterson was missing for 4 months until finally they discovered her body. But in that time, people thought that they saw her. Madeline McCann was just this little adorable four-year-old 14 years ago. She went missing in Portugal. We've never found her, and the tips still come in. And Natalie Holloway, 16 years ago, you know, Aruba disappeared, and lots of tips again of people they thought might be Natalie. The difference between some of those is that they're adults, some are children, some are domestic, some are international. Help me with that metric and how that makes things different with all the tips that come in on those kinds of cases.
Yeah, not to make light of this, but people are still calling in and saying they've seen D.B. Cooper and Jimmy Hoffa, even Elvis. So there has to be a lot of organization around this. You have to have a software program that is set up specifically to handle intake leads, prioritize those leads, farm those leads out where they need to go. And then you have to make sure that you withhold some detail, and enough detail so that when people call in, you can test what you know against what they're calling in on. So that's why you see the FBI withholding a good amount of detail on this case. You know, they're not talking at all, because they want to make sure that they still have some credibility testers, if you will, for when those calls come in. And as you pointed out,
Ashley, like John Mark Carr, remember him?
Right.
With JonBenet Ramsey, he was weird, and he said, yeah, I did it, and then he didn't know the thing that they knew, that the rest of us, you know, didn't know. Can I ask you about that epic errand run, Chris, that went on today? Mr. and Mrs. Laundrie were out at a bank, and and an AT&T store, and a FedEx location, and I wouldn't care, except for those are three places that are kind of interesting when your son is on the run and is a wanted fugitive, a national fugitive. So Brian Enten said he didn't see any G-men following them. Somebody was following them, right? Somebody's watching what it is they're doing, right?
Well, they're not following them physically. They're following them virtually by monitoring bank transactions. They can go to AT&T and see what transaction took place there. They can go to the FedEx and, of course, get the records from that. I suspect there is some light surveillance going on. You can't have a surveillance without having an airplane in the air and about five cars if you want to do it discreetly. If you want to do it overtly, you can have just a couple of cars. But it sounded like there wasn't much surveillance going on. So I got to think that they're monitoring their financial transactions, and that pretty much tells the story.
So I have another question for you about something I saw on CNN on Friday night. They had a sit-down interview with the Northport Police PIO, Public Information Officer Josh Taylor. And the reporter asked, Randy Kay asked, how did you lose him? Like, shouldn't you have been tailing him, probable cause or not? And he said this, and I'm going to read from their transcript. It says, he said, I mean, what are we supposed to do? You're going to go tree to tree, following back through the woods? I mean, you know, it just wasn't there with the information we had in this case. And prior to that, Chris Wecker, he said, a guy goes for a walk in the woods and we're supposed to do all that. And Randy Kay was actually asking him about the 13th, the day that his parents said he went for a hike. So my question to you is, yes, aren't they supposed to do that? On that day, when they're under such suspicion, you do follow him tree to tree. You don't let a guy walk into the woods and then walk wherever he is now.
Yeah, he's the prime suspect in a missing person case. And I'm not going to judge the police department too harshly, Northport, because they don't have much resources. I don't think there was a good amount of coordination between them and the police department in Montana and Wyoming. I don't think the FBI was in the case yet. They would have had the resources to do that type of surveillance. But I would have been doing some kind of loose surveillance on him just to make sure that they had a general sense of where he was. They didn't maybe necessarily have to follow right behind him into the woods, but having a good sense of where he was going, what he was doing, would have been a pretty sound investigative strategy at that point. Again, he was a prime suspect in a missing person case where it was highly likely that there was foul play.
Yeah, you're so much more gentle than I am in the way you say that so eloquently. Chris Wecker, I always love talking to you. Come back again, will you?
Thank you, Ashley.
Thank you. And after the break, as promised, Brian Enten is back. He's going to answer your questions about the case. Send them to TV Ashley on the Twitter and at Brian Enten on the Twitter. Back right after this. Welcome back, everyone. Brian Enten back by popular demand because you got questions and he's got answers. Are you ready, Brian?
I'm ready.
Okay, here we go. We're going to start with Jennifer. Jennifer on Twitter says, have any of Brian, not your Brian, Brian Laundrie's old girlfriends come out with regard to Brian's temperament?
I'll try to go quick through these so we can get a lot in. No, we have not been able to find any of his former girlfriends. We would love to obviously talk to them if they exist. We also haven't been able to find very many friends of Brian's.
Okay, that's an excellent question from Jennifer. Catherine has this question for you, Brian. Where did Brian Laundrie work? How did he pay for the trip and the travel expenses?
Good question. We know he worked at the Publix, not very far from his parents' house behind me. Gabby also worked there for a short time. In terms of how they paid for the van and all of the expenses of the travel, we're not really sure.
I'm going to jump to this one. It's Coffee Addict. Coffee Addict on Twitter asks, what day did the Laundries secure their lawyer, Stephen Berlino?
That is a very good question that we would love to know the answer to. We've asked Mr. Bertolino that. He won't give us the exact day. But remember that Mr. Bertolino and the Laundries go way back. They're family friends. They've known each other for a long time. So I don't think it's the kind of situation where they called him up and hired him one day. They had been in communication for quite some time.
Could have been calling their pal for friends. Good one. Okay. So Kathy asks, in the body cam video, this is in Moab, Gabby asked to call her parents. And the officer had said she could. The female ranger at one point says, I'll let you get back to your parents. If they, the parents, didn't know about the incident, who did she call? Do they know? Someone knew what was going on. Because there's a picture of Gabby, you know, behind the window in the car, in the cruiser, on the phone with someone.
Yeah, in the part of the video, it looks like she's on the phone. We don't know the answer to that question. That answer may lie in the body camera video with the female ranger. There's body camera video we don't have our hands on. Gabby had a one-on-one conversation with that female ranger. We've requested the video. It's difficult to get because it's through the National Park Service. We were initially denied when we tried to get it because of the FBI investigation.
Okay. Ed has this question. Why don't police pull search warrants to look for a bunker or a panic room in the Laundry home?
Well, we know that they did do a search warrant at the Laundry home several weeks ago. You remember they went inside. They were inside for hours and hours and hours. So during that time, I would presume that they checked everywhere in the attic and other places, too.
And that bunker has been dispelled in the back, the flower garden hand thing. That's a conspiracy theory that's been dispelled, but it sure made for some amazing viewing for a while there. Sherry asks this question, Brian. Who would have jurisdiction for potential charges against the parents, the FBI or Northport?
That's a good question. Maybe you can weigh on this one, Ashley. I think it would be the FBI, though, since this is now an FBI investigation that's based out of FBI Denver.
Yeah, so that it's kind of a twofer. If there's any kind of conspiracy with regard to any federal charges that are coming down, that's something that they would have to answer to, and that would be the FBI. Don't suspect that there's a potential for them to be conspiring in the bank fraud unless they cut up a card or got rid of it for them, and there'd be some, you know, exposure there. But then if there's any kind of obstruction of justice or lying to the Northport police, that would be a Northport story, and they'd have to face the music in Northport there as well. I'm just going to ask you a 10-second question because I've got 20 seconds left. Any sight of them tonight, or are they dark windows?
No sight of them tonight. It's dark out here, but quickly look at the memorial. I wanted to show you this earlier. Ashley, it's grown a bit. More signs, some balloons. No sign of the laundry since they went out on their shopping expedition today.
Oh, well, you're just so great. Thank you for doing all those questions rapid fire, Brian. And thank Luis for staying up late as well and giving me that last shot of the memorial. I appreciate it from both of you. And I hope we'll see you again tomorrow. Thanks, Brian. And all of you, thank you for being with us. A lot of breaking news and a lot of stories on Murdoch and the Gabby Petito story. Stay with us right here on Banfield. We'll see you again tomorrow night.